Welcome back, everyone. We're diving into some fascinating stuff today. It's all about the book of Deuteronomy, specifically chapter 12.
Ah, Deuteronomy 12, a real treasure trove of scholarly debate.
You got that right. So these lecture notes you sent over, they're from a Dr. Robert Vannoy's class, right?
Yep, that's him. Seems you've been digging into the whole centralized place of worship thing, huh?
That's the one. And let me tell you, it's a lot more complicated than I initially thought.
Oh, absolutely. Not exactly a straightforward, you know, read it and you get it kind of passage.
Not at all. And these notes, especially the stuff on De Halwarda, really highlight that. Different scholars, different interpretations, different ideas about how ancient Israelite religion actually worked on the ground, so to speak.
It's like trying to piece together a puzzle, but with like half the pieces missing and some extra ones from a different puzzle thrown in.
Perfect analogy. So for our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with Deuteronomy 12, let's set the stage. What's the basic gist of this chapter and why has it caused so much discussion among scholars?
All right. So Deuteronomy 12, the short version is, it's basically laying down the law about where the Israelites can offer sacrifices.
Okay. Sacrifices. Got it. Kind of a big deal in ancient Israelite religion, right?
Huge deal. Like the central act of worship. And Deuteronomy 12 is saying, hey, you can't just do this anywhere you feel like it.
There are rules, regulations, designated spots.
You got it. Now, the traditional interpretation, and this is where Wellhausen comes in, is that Deuteronomy 12 is advocating for one central sanctuary, one place where all sacrifices should be offered.
Ah, Wellhausen, big name in biblical scholarship, right? The guy who really shook things up.
That's the one. So Wellhausen saw Israelite religion as evolving in stages. First, you have this early period with altars and sacrifices happening all over the place, kind of a decentralized system.
So like your neighbor could be offering a sacrifice to, who was it, Yahweh?
Yahweh, yep. Your neighbor could be offering a sacrifice to Yahweh in their backyard, and it was all good.
Wild. So how do we get from backyard barbecues, I mean, sacrifices, to this idea of one central temple, one designated spot?
Well, according to Wellhausen, the prophets start pushing for centralization. They're saying, hey, there's only one true God, and he deserves one special place of worship.
Okay, prophets shaking things up as usual.
Pretty much their MO, right? And then you have King Josiah in the 7th century B.C., he takes this idea and runs with it big time, implements these reforms, tries to wipe out all those local altars and centralizes everything at the temple in Jerusalem.
Josiah, the one temple to rule them all kind of king.
You could say that.
Yeah.
And then after the exile, when the Israelites are allowed to return to their land, this idea of Jerusalem as the place to worship really solidifies.
So that's Wellhausen's take, multiple sanctuaries. Then the prophets push for centralization, Josiah makes it happen, and the exile seals the deal.
Exactly. But you know how it is with biblical scholarship, right? There's always another layer, another perspective. Enter D. Halwarda.
Halwarda. That's the scholar highlighted in these lecture notes, the one who's challenging Wellhausen's whole theory, right?
Right. Halwarda looks at the historical books of the Bible, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, and he's like, wait a minute, this whole multiple altars are bad thing doesn't seem to be a problem before Josiah.
Okay, hold on. Back up. So he's saying that having multiple places of worship wasn't necessarily seen as a no-no before Josiah's reforms.
That's his argument. He says there's actually quite a bit of evidence to suggest that it was pretty standard practice for quite a while.
Wow. Okay, now I'm really intrigued. What kind of evidence are we talking about? Give me some examples.
Well, one of the big ones Halwarda points to is Elijah. You know, the prophet who had that epic showdown with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel.
Oh, yeah. Elijah. Fire from heaven. Good stuff.
Right. So after that whole drama, Elijah ends up fleeing for his life because Queen Jezebel is out to get him. And while he's hiding out in the wilderness, feeling pretty down, he complains to God. He says, the people of Israel have thrown down your altars.
Altars, plural, like more than one.
Exactly. And Halwarda says, look, if having multiple altars was already considered a major sin at this point, wouldn't Elijah have mentioned that? His complaint seems to suggest that it wasn't inherently problematic at that time.
That's a really good point. If the issue was that people were just abandoning worship altogether, he would have phrased it differently. But he's specifically upset about the destruction of altars.
Exactly. And there are other examples, too. Take Samuel, for instance. We see him offering sacrifices at various locations. Ramah, Mizpah, Gilgal. Nobody seems to bat an eye. It seems perfectly normal, especially for a guy like Samuel, a major religious figure.
So we've got Elijah upset about the destruction of multiple altars. And we've got Samuel, this revered prophet, conducting sacrifices all over the place. It's starting to look like Wellhausen's Altars Everywhere phase might have lasted a lot longer than he thought.
That's what Hallward is suggesting. And get this, he even brings up David. You know, David, the future king, the giant slayer.
Hard to forget David. What's he doing in all of this?
Well, there's this incident where David is supposed to be at King Saul's table for a meal, but he's a no-show. And the excuse given is that he's gone to Bethlehem to participate in a family sacrifice.
So he dishes dinner with the king to go offer a sacrifice somewhere else.
Yep, and nobody freaks out. It seems like this journey to a specific location for a sacrifice was perfectly acceptable, not some, you know, rebellious act against a centralized system.
All right, so we've got Elijah, Samuel, now David, all seemingly operating under a system where multiple altars and locations for sacrifices are A-okay. But what about that argument I've heard? The one that says Deuteronomy 12's command for centralization only kicked in after the Israelites had achieved rest from their enemies. Doesn't that support Wellhausen's idea of a later dating?
That's the million-dollar question. And that's where things get really, really interesting. But you know how it goes in biblical scholarship? Nothing is ever simple.
You're telling me. Sounds like this idea of rest is where things get especially tricky.
You got it. And that's where we'll pick up next time.
Okay, so last time, we left off with this whole idea of rest in Deuteronomy 12 and how it basically throws a wrench into the debate over when exactly this whole one God, one temple idea really became a thing in ancient Israel. I'm ready to unpack this rest thing. What does it even mean? And why is it causing so much, you know, scholarly head scratching?
Well, the word rest in this context, it's kind of slippery.
Yeah.
You know, like it can be interpreted in a few different ways. Some scholars, they see it as referring to like a time of peace after the Israelites had conquered all their enemies, established a stable kingdom, you know, finally had a chance to catch their breath and get their religious house in order, so to speak.
So basically, once they weren't constantly fighting off Philistines or whoever, they could finally sit down and be like, all right, time to figure out this whole worship situation.
Yeah, something like that. But then you have Hawarda, right? He comes in with a different perspective. He's suggesting that rest in Deuteronomy 12, it might actually refer to a much earlier period. He thinks it could be talking about the peace that was achieved right after they conquered Canaan under Joshua's leadership.
Whoa, hold on. If Hallward is right, that means this whole command for a centralized place of worship could have been in effect way before, like David, Solomon, even before the United Monarchy. That really throws a wrench into the traditional timeline, doesn't it?
Oh, it definitely shakes things up. Hallward points to this passage in Joshua chapter 22. The Israelites are told to return to their lands because God has given them rest. And this suggests that, you know, maybe the concept of rest wasn't just about like political and military peace.
Okay, my mind is officially blown. So we have two very different interpretations of rest here. Mm. One that places the centralization command way later in Israelite history, and then another that says, hey, maybe it was there from the very beginning. This is where I get a little lost, honestly. How do we even begin to sort this out?
It's a tough one, no doubt. But let's shift gears for a second and think about another aspect of this whole debate that's really intriguing to me. If multiple altars were considered okay, or at least not a huge deal, for a significant period of time, why didn't the prophets ever, like, directly condemn them?
That's a great point. It seems like if having all these different altars scattered around was such a big problem, the prophets, you know, they would have been all over it. They weren't exactly known for holding back their opinions on, well, pretty much anything.
Exactly. They're always railing against idolatry, social injustice, you name it. But the whole multiple altars thing, it's kind of conspicuously absent from their, you know, pronouncements. Now, it's important to remember that this is what we call an argument from silence. Just because something isn't mentioned doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't happening or wasn't an issue.
Right, but it's still pretty strange, don't you think? You'd think someone, especially a prophet, would said something if it was such a blatant violation.
You would think. And this silence, it gets even more interesting when you factor in Wellhausen's theory, right? He saw the prophets as these, like, champions for this more centralized monotheistic system. But if having multiple altars was a common accepted part of early Israelite religion, it makes that picture a bit more complicated.
So maybe the prophets weren't trying to, like, reinvent the wheel so much as they were trying to emphasize certain aspects of worship that were already there. Like, they were trying to clarify what it meant to properly worship Yahweh, regardless of the specific location.
That's a really interesting possibility. It suggests a more nuanced understanding of their role in the whole evolution of Israelite religion. Maybe they weren't necessarily trying to create a brand new system, but more like refine and guide existing practices, you know.
This is seriously making me rethink this whole one God, one temple idea. It's way more multi-layered than I always assumed.
It just goes to show you, right? Ancient Israelite religion, like any religious tradition, it was complex, constantly evolving. We can't just read the Bible as some sort of straightforward historical document. We have to think about the context, different perspectives, consider the scholarly debates.
This deep dive has been a real eye-opener for me, honestly. We've gone from what seemed like a pretty simple instruction in Deuteronomy 12 to this, like, whirlwind tour of scholarly theories, biblical figures, ancient religious practices. I feel like I've learned so much, but at the same time, I have, like, a million more questions.
And that's the beauty of it, right? These lecture notes, Huarda's work, they're a fantastic starting point. They give you the tools to ask your own questions, dig deeper, draw your own conclusions. It's about the journey, not just the destination.
So to you, dear listener, I guess the question is, what stands out to you from all of this? We've explored this debate about Deuteronomy 12, different ways to understand that tricky rest clause, the prophet's silence on the whole altar issue. What does it all mean for how we understand ancient Israelite religion?
You've been introduced to some of the big players in this field, you know, Wellhausen, this giant of biblical scholarship, and Huarda, who wasn't afraid to challenge the status quo, so to speak.
But more importantly, I think you've gotten a sense of how complex and nuanced this whole topic really is. Ancient Israelite religion, it wasn't static. It was a living, breathing tradition that changed and evolved over time. And studying it, it requires careful thought, critical analysis, and honestly, a willingness to embrace some ambiguity.
Absolutely. And we haven't given you all the answers because, frankly, when it comes to these kinds of questions, historical and theological, there are no easy answers. But we've hopefully given you the tools to think for yourself, explore further, come to your own conclusions.
And hey, who knows? Maybe this deep dive will spark your own journey of discovery, right? Maybe you'll find yourself drawn to the world of biblical scholarship, or maybe you'll just start looking at your own religious beliefs and practices with, like, a fresh sense of curiosity.
Whatever path you choose, just remember the search for understanding. It's a journey. There's no real destination, you know?
Yeah.
It's about asking questions, challenging assumptions, and constantly seeking deeper meaning.
But before you go off and start building your own backyard altar.
We want to leave you with one final thought to ponder. If multiple altars weren't always seen as a problem in ancient Israel, what does that tell us about their understanding of God? About the very nature of worship.
How do they view the relationship between, like, specific places, rituals, and their connection to the divine?
And what does this ongoing scholarly debate about Deuteronomy 12 tell us about our own assumptions about the Bible? About its history, its interpretation?
These are the kinds of questions to wrestle with, to talk about with friends, to research further. The conversation, dear listener, it's far from over. It's up to you to keep exploring.
You know, it's funny. We started this whole deep dive thinking would be like unpacking a simple instruction about where to worship, but it's really turned into something so much bigger, hasn't it? Yeah, it's amazing how just one chapter in Deuteronomy can just like open up all these questions about, you know, history, religion, and how we even approach these ancient texts in the first place.
And I think what's so fascinating to me is that this debate isn't just some like academic exercise. You know, it's not just about dusty old scrolls. It's about how we understand the evolution of religious ideas, how people relate to their God, and really how cultures change and adapt over time.
Yeah, it really highlights this idea that the Bible is not like this monolithic, unchanging document. You know, it's a collection of texts written and compiled over centuries, reflecting different viewpoints, different understandings of faith.
So for our listener who's been with us on this journey through Deuteronomy 12, what would you say is like the big takeaway, the thing you really hope they walk away with?
I hope they walk away with a sense of curiosity, you know, and a desire to dig deeper. I mean, we've only just scratched the surface here, but hopefully we've provided enough, you know, sparks to ignite a passion for exploring these questions further.
I love that it's like we've given them a map, but it's up to them to chart their own course through this fascinating world of ancient Israelite religion.
Exactly. And who knows, maybe they'll even discover something new, you know, a fresh perspective that adds to the ongoing scholarly conversation.
Speaking of discoveries, I got to ask, what was the thing that surprised you the most as we were prepping for this deep dive? Was there like a moment where you were just like, wait, what? I never knew that.
Honestly, it was Huarda's argument about rest.
No.
The idea that one word could be interpreted in such wildly different ways with like huge implications for how we understand the timeline of Israeli worship. that was a real head scratcher for me.
I hear you. It makes you realize that you can't take anything for granted when you're dealing with these ancient texts. Gotta be willing to question your assumptions and be open to, you know, multiple viewpoints.
And that's the beauty of scholarship, right?
Yeah.
Is this constant process of discovery and debate and refinement. It's not about finding the right answer, you know. It's about engaging in this thoughtful and informed conversation with the past.
Well said. So, dear listener, as we wrap up this deep dive, we encourage you to continue the exploration. Don't be afraid to ask the tough questions, challenge those traditional interpretations, and really just delve into this rich and complex world of biblical scholarship.
And who knows, maybe someday you'll be the one presenting that groundbreaking new theory that changes how we understand ancient Israelite religion.
That's the beauty of it all, right? All right. There's always more to discover, more to learn, and definitely more to debate.
Until next time, keep diving deep.